No, you were fabulous. You were perfect.
In Leadville, Colorado.
All right.
It's about 110 miles south of Denver, up in the mountains.
Yeah, southwest.
Right.
And high up. Leadville's one of the highest
cities.
2 miles high. Right. And so there was a Catholic church there?
The Annunciation Church.
Okay. And now, Stuart, how long ago was it that he committed suicide?
He committed suicide in May of 1994.
Okay.
So it's been 10 years. It'll be 10 years.
Okay. And so what I would like us to do, and thank you for bringing this letter in. It's a devastating letter to read. It helps, you know, most of us are only familiar with the scandal of the priest molesting children, mostly boys, only through media accounts, and it doesn't usually hit home. It sounds terrible. It sounds horrific. But this letter, for me, made it hit home when you guys attend Denver Bible Church, and Stuart's brother, Stuart has a brother who's Scott, a younger brother, and he would like something to be done about his brother's death, but he travels a lot. He travels
out of the country with his business. And, doesn't have a lot of time.
Yeah, and he says he doesn't have it in him to investigate his brother's death, but he wished something more could be done or known.
Right.
And so you brought this letter in, and I thought, here's what we'll do. We can't just read it because Stuart, how do you pronounce his last name?
Stuart Saki.
Stuart Saki, your cousin. What's the exact relationship between you and Stuart?
My grandfather and his grandmother were siblings in Leadville.
Okay. They were brother and sister.
Right.
And so in small town, Leadville.
Very small.
Yeah. Okay. So Stuart's brother would like it if you could perhaps find out more about how this happened, why did it happen. And this letter, I'd like to read through the letter, but I was about to say we can't read it verbatim because Stuart is too
graphic.
He's telling this priest exactly, he's reminding him what he did 24 years earlier.
Right.
And so, of course, we will edit out the graphic sections. But I'll start reading it, and feel free to comment if you'd like as we go through.
Okay.
Okay? So this was written. He died in 1994.
Right.
And he had gone for counseling for his alcoholism a short time before that, within the last couple of years.
Right. I think he had gone on two occasions.
Okay. And this letter with – he gives a timestamp right off the bat. It's been 24 years since you sexually molested me. So we know it was near the end of his life
right.
that he wrote this. Okay. Dear Neil – Neil is the name of the priest.
Right.
Dear Neil – he doesn't say Father Neil. Or he says, Dear Neil, it has been 24 years since you sexually molested me. I also have been an alcoholic for 24 years. And this is a handwritten letter. It's not typed into a keyboard. I don't know. So I have also been an alcoholic for 24 years. I don't know if there is a correlation time-wise, but I think so. I was young, so it sounds like he's trying to take responsibility for his alcoholism, but maybe it was not just a coincidence.
Right.
I was young and vulnerable when this happened. My father had just died, and you were unhappy as a priest. You were fun to be around, hunting, flying, building computers, and traveling. You always scared me, though, by talking so much about sex and sin. You would ask me before serving Mass at the hospital if I had, and I'm going to leave an edit here, blank, he mentioned a sexual act, and if I needed to go to confession. Now, this priest served Mass at the hospital. Do you know what hospital? Would that have been?
That would have been St. Vincent's Hospital. That's the only hospital in Leadville.
All right. St. Vincent's. Let me jot that down here. St. Vincent's Hospital. Okay. So before serving Mass, Father Neil would ask Stuart if he'd committed a sexual act and if he needed to go to confession.
Right.
You played sex tapes in the car while we traveled. I should have guessed something was up. And, you know, a young boy, it's hearing something like that, it's rather dramatic. And so, you know, if he was a wise, mature, grown-up 15-year-old boy who had lost his dad, he would have said, hey, Mom, this guy is messed up. But he was seduced by this predator. All right, the letter continues. I remember sleeping with you on a trip to Canada and waking up with you, and now we'll edit this out, which is basically performing a sex act on Stuart. I was scared to death and afraid to move. Then in Sterling, that's Sterling, Colorado?
I believe that's where he's from, the priest.
The priest is from Sterling, you think?
I believe so.
All right. Let me write that down. Okay. Then in Sterling, Colorado, you got me drunk on lime vodka, and had the briefcase of pornography. And so he doesn't say a briefcase of pornography, but the briefcase, which means he, as he's writing this, he knows that this Father Neil is very aware of what briefcase. In other words, this briefcase had surfaced in more than one meeting.
I actually know that the younger brother, Scott, had gone on a trip to Sterling with this priest. Fortunately, nothing ever happened to him, but he remembers in the camper of his truck opening a drawer, and all kinds of little bottles of alcohol were in there. And he knows
little bottles like on an airplane?
Right. Little bottles of schnapps and whiskey and things like that.
And lime vodka.
Lime vodka. And he knew about the briefcase of pornography and was very shocked and didn't go again.
He never went again.
No.
But he So the younger brother corroborates that part, those particular details at least.
That and at, also on that particular trip to Sterling, this was also something that was witnessed by one of his friends, that Stuart was drunk in the bathroom on the lime vodka and that the priest was in the bathroom with him with the door closed for a long time.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's some corroboration of some of the particulars.
Right.
Okay. All right. So when in Sterling, you got me drunk on lime vodka and had the briefcase of pornography. Do you remember, and now I have to leave out the rest of the sentence. It's very specific. It's utterly disgusting and despicable what this priest did to this boy who had just lost his dad. You couldn't be more vulnerable as a young man. Then there was the trip to Denver where you got three of us drunk again. Okay, stop right there. So there was it was not just Stuart. You said on that one trip, his younger brother Scott had gone, but nothing happened. He just saw the pornography and the alcohol. But there were others on that trip also to Sterling?
There were other people with Scott on his trip, and there were other people apparently with Stuart on his trip.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know if they were victims of abuse.
Right.
And just haven't come forward.
But they have been willing to talk to some people about what they've seen.
One has. One individual has.
Okay. All right. So, So you got three of us drunk again. And that again, maybe that's first Stuart went and got, was made drunk. And then this priest brought three together, three young people apparently, and gave them alcohol and they all became drunk. And then you, writing to Father Neil, Stuart writes, and so you made three of us drunk again, and you climbed in my bed early in the morning, and again, we'll edit this out, performing a sex act on Stuart. I could never go with you again after that because I couldn't trust you. Well, of course not.
Right.
But here I am, 45 years old, the pastor of a church, saying, well, that should have been obvious a lot longer, earlier. But this is a kid, and it's a priest, and there's a relationship of trust and the position of authority and trust in the community and respect. And the priest is giving these young boys things that young boys are interested in, pornography, alcohol. You know, kids will go down that route without careful guidance and supervision and protection. So, okay, let's continue. What happened? We're halfway through the letter, more than halfway through. What happened to me was tremendous guilt of going to hell. So, and that's tragic. Beyond all the tragedies.
Just horrible.
Yeah, what a nightmare. This was something I never talked to anyone about until I was 28 years old. I could never get close to another man in my life. I hate homosexuals. And hate it myself. You represented religion, and religion was tied to my faith in God. I lost both.
That just breaks my heart.
Yeah, because you knew him as a young boy growing up.
Right.
Yeah, and every human being is this precious, eternal soul. And it could be nurtured and grow into, you know, eternal happiness and paradise with God, or it could be utterly crushed and destroyed by sin and by predators. And so this is why this scandal with the Catholic Church, you know, some Catholics say it's not fair that the church is going through this, but the destruction and the death that's been, you know, harvested because of this evil is just unspeakable and immeasurable. And back in, I don't know if it was the 1950s or when, but when Roman Catholic seminaries throughout North America began a policy of welcoming homosexuals to welcoming them to enroll and become seminarians as long as they too would take the pledge of celibacy. And so when you do that, when the Roman Catholic Church welcomed homosexuals into their seminaries, normally a ministry would say, well, if you're a homosexual, you have deep-seated spiritual and emotional problems, and you're not qualified to be a minister. But the Roman Catholic seminaries were themselves obviously spiritually dead, broken, and perverse. And so they became magnets for homosexuals. And now, 40, 50 years later, we see the consequences.
You're right.
The devastation. Okay, so, and you know what's interesting, what Stuart writes here? He writes that I hate it myself, and you represented religion, and religion was tied to my faith in God. I lost both. He was able, even in his broken state, he was able to recognize that there very well could be a difference between religion and God.
Right.
But he tragically said, I lost both. You know, people, when you put your eyes on other human beings, you are probably going to be disappointed. And that's why the Bible tells us to put our eyes on Jesus Christ and put our hope and trust in God. And when we put our hope in one another, we're bound to be let down too frequently.
Well, and I think that I've heard since then that a lot of parents that had troubled kids, adolescents, would send them to him for help,
this priest.
And counseling, thinking that because he is like an authority figure, he is with the church. He will know how to fix the problem, and he created the biggest.
Yeah. Donna, I don't know if you've heard a young man, married guy from Indianapolis, called into this show and talked to me about he grew up Catholic, and the Catholic priest started to invite him to go to movies, go do things together. And the priest started talking about sexual morality and do you need confession? The same kind of routine. And this guy was maybe a little stronger, a little wiser, and stopped it. But this priest was definitely pursuing him over a period of a couple years. And, you know, he's called the diocese there in Indianapolis. And there didn't seem to be a real interest in speaking to him and working this out, finding out what happened. And that's sadly, when we get done with this letter, let's find out, let's talk about the latest. What has the Archdiocese of Denver, have they been willing to tell you guys as the family members if this priest has been defrocked, if he's been reprimanded, if he's... You know, what's happened? If he had molested others and was moved from one parish to another? But let's finish the letter first. I know you even asked my mom out on dates. So this was one priest out of control.
Very much so.
Yeah. But, you know, the one part of the problem is the seminaries welcoming homosexuals. It's, you just apply, and the fact that you're homosexual was not counted against you in Roman Catholic seminaries in America. And that started decades ago. But another problem is you go way back 2,000 years ago where the Apostle Paul writes to Timothy, and this isn't a priest or a bishop. This is an apostle. The Apostle Paul, who met Christ on the road to Damascus, and God authorized Paul to write about a third of the New Testament. So he's a significant authority for Christians. And the Apostle Paul wrote that here are the qualifications of being an elder or a bishop. He's basically a minister. That you should be the husband of one wife. The husband of one wife. And so to go from that to saying you can't be married is a complete retraction of what the New Testament says is appropriate for being a minister, to what the Roman Catholic says, you can't be married. Paul said in two letters to Titus and to Timothy, he said, you should be a husband of one wife. And elsewhere, he points out that, you know, sexual immorality, the passion that results, the lust, marriage is a really good way to deal in a healthy and right and godly way with something that could get out of control. And so now you have the whole Roman Catholic Church saying men who want to be in the ministry can't get married. And you're just asking for men out of control with sexual immorality not married and just burning in their lust one for another. Men with men committing what is shameful. That's what the Apostle Paul wrote in Romans chapter 1.
Right.
So it's what a tragedy. Okay, so this was a priest utterly out of control. I know you even asked my mom out on dates, but she rejected as she knew your actions were immoral. When I was 22, I saw you at an airport going to a fire. Now, going to a fire, what's he saying there?
He was probably traveling to a forest area to help put out a fire.
Since he was with the Division of Wildlife, right. Firefighter, maybe he was going to Grand Junction or wherever.
Right,
it somewhere. Was quicker to fly, Durango, quicker to fly than drive.
Right.
So he went to the airport, probably Stapleton. When I was 22, I saw you at an airport going to a fire. I wanted to kill you. I have had many emotional hangups over your perverted actions. I have isolated myself in life and only wanted to be around women. I would not make or associate with male friends. And that is so devastating.
It is.
You know, I have so many great male friends. I can't even count them all. And that's just a huge source of, you know, enjoyment in life. Guys, you know, going out with the guys and whatever. Going hiking. I don't feel you are responsible for my alcoholism, but you are a cause of a lot of my loneliness. I can forgive you because you were sick and had a problem. I also have to forgive myself as I have carried a lot of hate and anger. That's the end of the letter.
Right.
Wow. What a tragedy. One homosexual priest, and who knows the destruction that was caused beyond Stuart. We know this much.
Right.
And even of Stuart's suffering, we only just got a little glimpse, a small glimpse of it. So, Donna, I know that you and your husband brought this letter to me a while back. And you guys attend Denver Bible Church.
Right.
So I called the Roman Catholic, the Denver Archdiocese, and said that we have a family in our church who has a relative, as sort of a cousin, who left a letter before he committed suicide giving details of having been molested by a priest. And this family, they have just two questions. They want to know if this priest had been previously accused of molesting others and if he had been moved to the Leadville Diocese after an accusations.
Right.
Because that seems like it would fit a pattern of the Catholic Church, rather than dealing and acknowledging with the child molestation that was going on in its ranks, they hushed it up and moved the priest so that they could victimize someone all over, brand new, unknown, come in a trusted environment, and the predatory acts continued.
Right.
And so those were your two questions.
Right.
And I was told that, well, certainly they couldn't give that information out, not to me, not over the phone, but you guys would have to go down there. So you went down to the Denver Archdiocese, and were they willing to answer those questions?
No, they weren't willing at all. He told us that.
Who was he?
Friar.
Friar. His last name was Friar?
His last name was Friar.
So he was a priest.
In charge of this type of situation.
In charge of personnel? He was like a Father Friar was his name.
Right.
F-R-I-A-R?
F-R-Y-A-R.
F-R-Y-A-R. Okay. And what did he tell you?
He told us that he was very sorry about what happened, wanted to know if we had left the Catholic Church because of that, and that, sorry, he couldn't give me any information because, like a corporation like IBM, those records are confidential and he could not give me any information.
So these are personnel records.
Right.
And the Denver Archdiocese is like IBM.
Right.
So it seems to me that that's contrary to a spirit of contrition, to be sorry, to acknowledge that we have done wrong and people are hurt.
Right.
And you guys are asking, we want to know If, in other words, could the archdiocese have known about this?
Prior to the Leadville.
Yeah. Were there other accusations? Had he been moved because of accusations?
Right.
Those are reasonable questions. And so now Stuart Saki, that's how you pronounce his last name, S-A-U-C-K-E, yes. His brother Scott has given you permission and authority to look into this.
Right.
And saying he, right now, it's hard for him to do, and he would like to find out more. And he even wants some kind of justice to come from this, even though it's so long ago.
This former priest, Neil Hewitt, had talked to Scott right after Stuart's suicide and promised him full disclosure if they could meet somewhere, like a restaurant. And Scott agreed to that, to which he never showed up.
Okay. Who never showed up?
Neil Hewitt never showed up.
Okay. Now, explain that to me. After Stuart committed suicide, he took a gun and put it in his mouth and shot himself, killed himself as a firefighter. And so then the priest found out about the death.
He had a lot of phone calls because nobody knew of this situation until the suicide. When this letter came out at Stuart's funeral,
people thought this priest was a friend. He'd want to know.
They were furious, and he had many calls, so he knew.
Oh, the family was furious.
Family and
when
friend.
They found this letter.
Right. No one knew about
this. Oh, my. So they called this priest, Father Neil Hewitt, and who lives in the Denver area.
Yes, he does.
And he told Scott, the younger brother, he would meet with him. And how did you term that?
He promised him, he admitted that he had sexually molested Stuart and that he would like to meet with him and give him full disclosure of everything that happened and set up a day, a time when they could go and meet at this restaurant, and had called Scott the day prior and said, I can't meet you, and that was all.
Right.
So.
Okay. Now, is Father Neil Stuart, is he still a priest with the Denver Archdiocese, the Roman Catholic Church?
From what I know, he left the church around 81 to marry. He married a woman, and they moved to the Denver area to Arvada. And as far as I know, the record shows that he was not terminated, if that's the word from the Catholic Church, but he is kind of like on leave of absence. So my concern is that he could be divorced tomorrow and be back in the Catholic Church in 2 days.
Since he's not been defrocked.
Right.
He's just taken a leave of absence.
Right.
He's not getting paid.
Right.
All right. So you would still like those questions answered?
I sure would.
Well, here's what I think that we should do, Donna. I think we should take a copy of this letter again, a tape of this show, and bring them to the Denver Archdiocese. Ask for, if the bishop, maybe direct it to the bishop, and say, we have these two questions, and we think they're reasonable questions, and the Denver Archdiocese should, if it's contrite, care enough about the victims' families to answer these questions.
Yeah, they just came out with
the letter in the news, in the Denver Post.
That
seven priests since 1950 were molesters.
Right. The lowest level of anywhere in the country.
In the country. And is this one of those priests?
Well, they won't disclose the names or where the
They won't say the names. So if 500 kids were molested, how do you know? You think, well, my molester might be one of those seven.
He might be or he might not be.
There's no way to know. They won't say which churches, where the molestations occurred.
No.
So this is a reasonable these are reasonable questions. And, Donna, we're going to see. We'll take another effort with you.
I appreciate it so much.
And see if we could get these answers. And for Scott, Stuart's brother, and even for Stuart.
Right.
So thank you very much, Donna Ballantyne, for joining us in studio for this episode of Bob and Yart Live. Christianity is not only about reading the Bible, praying, and telling one another, brother, bless you for calling. Christianity is about fighting the fight. between right and wrong. So this is Bob Baniert reminding you to do right and risk the consequences. Stay tuned for Bob Baniert Live, but first, I am Pastor Bob Baniert with our Denver Bible Church update. This is it, this week until Thursday night only. So tonight and two more nights, Bob Baniert Live and the Denver Bible Church update are airing in Denver at 7 p.m. in the evening. And then Thursday, that's it. After that, the show will only be in the afternoon in Denver and on the web, like usual, at kgov.com. But it'll be 3 in the afternoon, Monday through Friday, and we're thrilled because then we're at full power all year long. Full power, and we're just thrilled about that because that gets Bob Baniert Live into most of the surrounding states around Colorado. So you can feel free to call in with your Bible questions or discussions of current events. Now, today at 3 o'clock, we read on the air the full text of two ads that were run by Denver Bible Church. And these were not run in a Denver newspaper. They were run back in Washington, D.C. in the Washington Times. Now, why would a Denver church run quarter-page newspaper ads in the Washington Times? Well, that newspaper goes to it goes to Capitol Hill, the Pentagon, the White House. In fact, it goes to thousands of copies of the Washington Times are delivered to the seat of our government in Washington, D.C. And so Denver Bible Church wanted to make two points. We ran two ads within 2 weeks last year. The first was, thank you, President Bush, for your leadership in liberating 40 million Iraqis and Afghans and connecting their liberty to our self-defense and our war on terror. And we said, Mr. President, the hardest part lies ahead. Now we ask you to bring the same moral clarity to the killing of more than 40 million unborn children in our own country. To remove the speck from our neighbor's eye, Jesus said we must take the log out of our own. Millions of Christians have voted for you, Mr. President, as a pro-life candidate. Yet you select pro-choice judges and high officials. Your legacy will depend on how you confront the killing of innocent children here in America. Every day, abortionists kill hundreds of babies old enough to suck their thumbs who are still in their first trimester. And abortionists kill these babies without real opposition from you. So please, Mr. President, do the right thing and fight against the intentional killing of all unborn children, regardless of the political risk to you. So that was a letter that we ran in the Washington Times, sponsored by DenverBibleChurch.org, a year ago to the president. And then we followed up with another one 2 weeks later, which showed an ace of spades on the top of a deck of cards. And the face on the ace of spades is that of Yasser Arafat. And the headline of the ad, it says, Next. Next, Yasser Arafat. And that ad, so the one ad called for President Bush to protect innocent children from being killed. And 2 weeks later, another ad sponsored by Denver Bible Church called for President Bush to recognize that Yasser Arafat is a terrorist and that he should be next. He shouldn't be protected. He should be killed as the father of modern terrorism. Because in the Bible, God says, do not profane me, killing people who should not die and keeping people alive who should not live. That's God's position in the Bible. Don't kill people who should not die and do not keep people alive who should not live. That's the bottom line there. So, all right. Hey, only two more Denver Bible Church updates to go. After that, you're going to have no choice. You're going to have to come out and visit us at Denver Bible Church right near Wadsworth and Hampton on Sunday, Sunday morning Sunday school worship, Sunday night Bible study. And right now, stay tuned for Bob Baniert Live.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. I am Bob Enyart, America's most popular self-proclaimed right-wing religious fanatic, homophobic, anti-choice talk show host. Our phone number is 1-800-8-ENYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. I get a call a few weeks ago on the show, and the caller said, "Hey, Bob, are you aware that your son is in jail?" I said, "What?" "My son Nathaniel's in jail, so Nathaniel, it's good to see you out of jail."
"Hey, Dad, how's it going?"
"Doing well, son. You're with the Survivors pro-life group, and I'd like you to tell me about Survivors, now that you're back in Denver for a week, tell me about Survivors and who's your friend here?"
"Okay, well, Survivors is a group that goes around the country to different college campuses and high schools and does pro-life events, and we also just go to different, you know, different pro-life events, do whatever we want to do, and we just, you know, just show the truth about abortion, tell what abortion really is, and show how it happens. My friend here is Jonathan. He's on the tours with me."
"Hey, Nate."
"Jonathan, how are you?"
"Just fine. How are you?"
"It's nice to meet you."
"Good to meet you."
"And so when you tell people about abortion, how do you do that?"
"Well, we stand and we hold very graphic but true depictions of what abortion really does in reality to an innocent human being. It shows babies who have been pulled apart, dismembered, in all three trimesters, both first, second, and third trimesters, by legal abortion procedures in America." "So we take these to college and high school campuses and confront the students there with the reality of abortion. And usually that, what that does is it winds up encouraging them to engage in dialogue, to think about where human dignity comes from."
"So, Jonathan, you're saying that it's legal to, in some places, to kill a baby in the third trimester?"
"Up to the day of birth. Up to the day of birth." "I'm from Kansas City, Missouri, over in Wichita, Kansas. They routinely, at a clinic run by Dr. George Tiller, routinely kill only third trimester children in that clinic for any reason. Any reason the mother chooses, they talk about Down syndrome, other reasons. But many normal, healthy children with others with problems like hydrocephalus that can be easily repaired by a stent. And they kill them. They just kill them."
"My friends had a baby with water on the brain.
Water on hydrocephalus.
Yes, sir. And they were told by their doctor they had to abort the baby because it would be deformed. It'd be a monster. And so thank God they were Christians, pro-lifers. And they said, of course not. We're not going to kill our baby.
Right.
If your baby is sick, if your baby is genetically deformed, it's going to die. It's not evil to let your baby die. But it's evil to kill your baby."
"That's right.
That's
right.
The evil part." And no, so they said, no, we're not going to kill our baby. And that baby was born and they put this little what's it called?
It's called a stent. It's a type of a stent that they put in there.
It's a little plastic tube.
Right.
And it drained the water in the baby's skull into his stomach. And so that it runs down through his body, and they put an extra bit of roll of it in his stomach so that as he grows, it just unrolls and it gets longer. And that baby now is about 12 years old, perfectly healthy, normal kid, little troublemaker, but perfectly normal kid.
Right. It's a routine procedure.
Yeah.
And you think about the Bible talks about, says there's six things that the Lord hates. Yea, seven are an abomination to him. Two of those are lying lips and hands that shed innocent blood. Hmm. And many of these physicians who have advised in cases like that for abortions are absolutely lying. Those are routine procedures, like you said, that can fix conditions like that. They're lying to justify these killings of innocent children. And again, the Lord hates hands that shed innocent blood.
So doctors, you know, when we've brought this up, we've been on the air for about 13 years, five nights a week. Mm-hmm. And when we bring this up, so often over the years, we get women who come and tell us on the air, they send us emails or letters. They tell us their own story about when their doctor told them they had to kill their baby because it was going to be a monster, deformed, it's dead, just the most terrible things. And they've resisted, and they have beautiful little babies today.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
What makes, Nathaniel, what do you think, or Jonathan, what motivates so many doctors, even ones who are not abortionists, what motivates them to exaggerate the dilemma, the trouble, and say you got to get an abortion?
Well, I would say that's, you know, they advocate one abortion, and so they're advocating killing someone. And then to feel good about themselves, they just keep on, you know, they have to keep on going on and saying, okay, well, you got to kill this one. You know, it just make themselves feel better. Say, oh, it's routine. Everybody does it.
So the more
they do it, they feel better about themselves. Like, yeah, everybody does it. It happens all the time.
It's like a defense mechanism. Since they're saying to other women, hey, you can kill your baby. Now they really want to find a good reason that nobody could argue with to kill a baby. So here's a great reason. This baby's going to be a deformed monster.
Yeah.
You have to kill this baby. So they cover up their guilt because God has made us with a conscience. And over time, you can harden your heart and become seared. Right. But that conscience, you know, God made it. And it's pretty tough to finally kill it.
Oh, absolutely. We have these organizations, professional organizations in America, like the American Medical Association, American Psychiatric Association, organizations that used to have at the core of their values, you know, a basic understanding at one point of human dignity. And usually it began at some point in history with an understanding that human rights come from God the Creator. But these organizations have abandoned, you know, over the years and officially abandoned these concepts of human dignity. And they're putting out doctors, you know, family doctors and MDs who have no basis for understanding where human dignity comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And if they understand it, they ignore it. They ignore it routinely and lead other people to do so. And there's no excuse particularly for these medical professionals because they know better. They know better.
They know better. And, you know, moms, women in America are typically more pro-life than our men. Not that that would matter because abortion is killing an unborn child. It doesn't matter what the surveys or the polls show.
Right. Yeah.
But women are typically more pro-life than men because women carry the babies.
Absolutely. Women are in tune with what's going on inside of their bodies. And, you know, as soon as a woman in the first trimester is pregnant, her body has already begun to go through changes that men can only imagine and read about. And to release hormones that are preparing her, even in those very, very early days for being a mother and for motherhood. And so they know intuitively, like you know, we sense that women know many things intuitively that men don't pick up on. They know intuitively that there is a child, a human being inside of them.
Well, a mom begins to connect, to identify with the baby at the very moment that she knows there is a baby.
Absolutely.
She begins to connect to that child. And a father, by the time the kid is in third or fourth grade, he's starting to think, you know, he's around here a lot. He might be my kid.
Maybe I should get to know him a little bit.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And so it does take longer for a man to bond with a baby. Not all men. Human beings are complex and different. But a man has to bond with the baby, and the mother bonds so quickly.
Yeah.
And so now today – that how many abortions have there been in the past, you know, since Roe v. Wade, 30-some years?
45 million.
About 45 million.
Yeah, well, reported, but, you know, there's a lot of that don't
– that are states, unreported.
States nowadays, some states just stop reporting.
Like California.
Yeah, because Planned Parenthood gives them such bogus numbers. They say, okay, well, they're lying to us anyways.
Yeah.
Why report these lying, bogus numbers? So we're just done reporting.
Well, we're going to go to a break. When we come back, I'm going to ask you guys why women get angry at seeing pictures of unborn children developing right after this.
At Bob Inyart Live and KGov.com, you'll find literature, audio, and video products that are a must for the library of any Christian interested in studying the truth of the Bible. You'll find essential material like the plot manuscript, an overview of the whole Bible that will clear up doctrinal issues. Then there's The Tree, a fun audio journey back to the Garden of Eden, where you'll learn about this most famous tree and its impact on humanity. Check out the Mount Moriah video. This video gives evidence for the resurrection, combining biblical and secular resources. It's a great witnessing tool. And don't forget the death penalty video. Learn that Jesus advocated the death penalty, and learn how God put the death penalty at the heart of the gospel. You can directly help Bob's outreach by subscribing to Best of Bob, Bob's Best 8 Shows of the Month, or build a Bible study library by ordering the monthly Bible albums. There's a lot more, so give us a call at 1-800-8-INYARD. That's 1-800-836-9278. 1-800-836-9278 or KGOV.com.
This is Bob Inyart here with a live commercial break. Hey, we've been talking this week about a manuscript that I've written. It's actually a labor of love for me. It's called The Plot. It's an overview of the whole Bible, 330 pages. And the philosophy behind The Plot is this. If, you know, Christians get saved, they go to Sunday school, they start studying the Bible, they read books on whatever is the idiosyncrasy of their church. Like, let's say it's baptism. lot of churches are strong on baptism, or say it's speaking in tongues, or let's say it's the end times, right? Whatever it is that their church is all into, or say whether or not you could lose your salvation. And so then this new Christian becomes an expert in some particular doctrines. But if you ask him general questions about the whole Bible, you could ask him 20 general questions and they might get one right or none, which is common. It's easy to put a test together like that. And what we think a big problem is that Christians do not have an overview of the whole Bible. They don't know how the whole story goes together. So we say, hey, before we become an expert on what separates us, let's first become an expert on the story of the Bible. What is the plot of the Bible? Then when we have that down, when we're strong on that, then let's become experts in our own denominational particulars. So that's what we've done with the plot. The plot, 330-page, an overview of the Bible. It's fun. 30-day money-back guarantee. You can get it by calling 1-800-8-N-YARDS or go online to kgov.com. We're back, Bob and Yurt Live, and I'm here with Nathaniel and Jonathan from Survivors. And you guys have a website?
Yes, www.survivors.la. We're revamping the website pretty soon.
All right, yeah. So survivors.la, like you're in Los Angeles, so
yeah,
LA.
Okay, and before the break, you asked, you know, why do women get so angry when they see pictures of fetal development?
Yeah, just not aborted babies, yeah, just the babies in the womb developing.
Yeah, it's because... Well, for most of them, they get mad about that. They've previously had abortions, and the doctors have lied to them and saying, you know, it's not a child, it's just a clump of tissue, it's not recognizable. And so they willingly believe the lie. Like, they know it's a lie, but they believe it anyways because they want to kill it. They want to feel good about killing
it. It's kind of willful ignorance.
Exactly it. Yeah, so they don't want to know the truth. Then you show them the truth. And that just proves beyond any shadow of a doubt that they killed their child, and so they hate you for it.
So they get angry just for seeing a little baby, like in Life magazine, sucking his thumb in the womb. Millions of women today, and I've seen it firsthand, you go to something like the People's Fair or the Colorado State Fair, and you have pictures of babies in the womb. That's it. Mm-hmm. At your booth. And women walk by, and they cuss you. They get vulgar. They get angry. And that's it. They're just seeing a little baby.
Yeah, and depending on where we are, those are at the most, you know, half of the women that we meet. Reality is that many of the women that see those images are, you know, like most people are you know, enjoy the beauty of watching the process, because on almost every one of our signs we have the diagram from conception all the way up to birth, the development, and it is a beautiful thing. But like Nathan said, there are many. In fact, we just talked to one today at I'm trying to remember the name of the university we were at today, Nathan. We go to
one in Greeley.
It was Northern Colorado.
UNC.
Yeah.
University of
Northern Colorado. And a lady, a young student there, did come up to us and look at the signs and respond very angrily, shouting at us about the images on the signs. And she walked away, you know, as we tried to dialogue with her, she walked away saying, yeah, you know, I did that to my child. Mm-hmm. And at a certain point, once we introduce those images, they can no longer, you know, talk about it as though it were just something
just the tissue.
Short of a human being.
Just a tumor. Yeah.
In fact, her...
Like Warren Hearn, the abortionist in Boulder, writes about it as though the baby is the equivalent of a tumor.
Yeah. It's terrible.
You know, what's interesting is many of these abortionists will write about it that way, and in their literature they talk about it that way. But personally, when you pin them down on it, they're perfectly comfortable. Many of the and reconcile themselves to the reality that it's a child.
Mm-hmm.
We were recently at a Refuse and Resist meeting. For those who don't know, Refuse and Resist is a radical liberal militant, you know, very well known for the militant liberal and pro-choice tactics. And they showed a documentary about an old abortionist, I think he's dead now, named Curtis Boyd, who had been performing abortions before it was even legal, before Roe versus Wade. He said in the documentary that, in fact, that he had been performing them, was performing an abortion when it became legal in 1973. And he, throughout the whole documentary, referred to what he was doing as a child. He referred to the fruit of the womb as a child.
And that's feminist writers, thinkers, activist leaders began to do that about 10 years ago publicly, mm-hmm. where they were saying, hey, look, we got to admit this is a human mm-hmm. being. Mm-hmm. It's a living human being, and we have the right to kill it because it's my life.
Yeah, and then they began to build those justifications. Oh, well, you know, the child intruded upon me almost as though the child had raped, you know,
right.
raping
them. And
woman.
Then even when they themselves will agree that it's a human, when they're teaching a class or telling other people, it's, oh, no, it's just a blob of tissue. So they know the truth. Mm. And when they talk to you, they'll tell you they know the truth. But talking to anybody else, they lie through their teeth. And so these kids are growing up coming out of these colleges. The kids and the professors say, oh, it's just a blob of tissue. And I had a girl at UNC come up to me, and she's like, you need to take my class on. We're learning all this stuff, and you guys are so wrong. You guys are lying and blah, blah, blah. And it's, what kind of class are you taking? I mean, you're not learning anything useful, because I asked her if she knew the law of biogenesis. She never even heard of that law.
The law of biogenesis, that life comes from life.
She thought you were talking about the Bible.
Life comes from life. Yeah. Life comes from life, and that kind creates its own kind. So I said, you know, if two humans come together, they make another human. They don't make something else that turns into a human.
Let me see if I can figure this out. I went to public school, so I'm a little slow. But if a father and a mother, human beings, reproduce, the offspring is A, alive, B, dead, C, I don't know.
Yeah.
So let me think. The baby is alive, and it's A, human, B, a cat, C, I don't know.
It's a human.
It's a human. So,
right.
So there's something in the womb that its heart is beating, so it's a living human.
Yeah, and I just want to add one more point to your little survey there. It's really funny. I was talking to them, and they wouldn't agree that it's alive. In the end, they agreed that it's alive, but they wouldn't agree that it's a human. I said, okay, well, what defines us humans? Isn't it our DNA? And they're like, no, it's not. I said, okay.
It's not our DNA. What is it? It's your political registration.
No, I said, okay.
It's your ACLU membership card.
I said, if it's not our DNA, name some physical scientific things that prove that we're human besides our DNA. And she goes, and the girl's like, you know, the girl from that class is like, oh, that's so easy. She goes, that, well, let's see, we're bipeds.
That
and
proves we're human.
Whatever. And she lists all these.
We're bipeds. Well,
no, she lists all these different physical features.
She might be a chimpanzee.
I know. But then I was trying to interrupt her and ask her, but she wouldn't let me. She wouldn't cut me off until she walked away. But I want to say, we're bipeds and our brain capacity is the size. We have all these other features. Really interesting. Well, what is it in us that makes us that way? What designs that we're bipeds and that we're our brain? And I couldn't get that question out, but, you know, it's obviously our DNA makes us bipeds. Yeah. Everything she listed is that way because of our DNA made us that way.
Right.
She didn't list one thing that our DNA didn't. So I said, so basically it's our DNA. So yes, we are human.
Right. So they're challenged.
I didn't want to hear anything about that.
They're challenged by simple biology that a baby in the womb is a living human.
Yeah.
They can't typically. The rank and file feminist pro-aborts, homosexuals, evolutionists, the rank and file typically can't admit it's a living human.
Right.
Not even that.
Yeah, it's a tumor.
Mm-hmm. You know, the New York Times did this article, 3-page article, that said that it should be legal to kill a baby after it's born for any reason for the first 30 days.
Yeah.
30 days after the baby's born. We got a video of that. You guys probably haven't seen that article. It came out about 10 years ago. But you should take that video, Nathaniel, when you leave here.
Yeah, I will.
Infanticide in the New York Times.
Yeah, I'd love to see that.
Yeah. They're arguing that for any reason it should be legal for 1 month after birth to kill a baby.
And this was 10 years ago.
Yeah.
This isn't just some new wave. This is 10 years ago.
Yeah. And there was almost no criticism nationwide of that article.
I've heard those. I'm really curious about that. I'd love to see that. I've heard those arguments, you know, based on the premise that, well, the infant child is not contributing anything to society. He's not contributing anything to the social structure.
What does a one-year-old contribute?
Right. I mean, that's the slope of.
When I read that article, we read it on when Bob in Your Life was a TV show, thankfully, so that the camera zoomed in at each line in the New York Times. I had the whole paper there while I'm reading the whole article on the air. And then I pulled out a copy of Discover Magazine, and Discover Magazine had this article by this Sarah Hardy, and she's an expert on some kind of chimps, and she argued that these chimps will kill their young after they're born for some reason, and therefore it's an evolutionary trait to kill your young.
Huh. Sure.
And so one of the sentences in Discover Magazine, that's owned by Disney, is that it was this, that infanticide is at one end of the spectrum of parental care. Wow. Because they argued that if you kill one baby, you'll have more time and energy for other babies.
Wow. Time and energy. Wow.
Yeah. And so that's in Discover magazine.
That's rather terrible.
It is terrible. And that's – once you start saying, hey, it's okay to kill, you know, innocent babies, where do you stop?
Yeah, that's not really where – you know, the debate has never hinged around defining human life. That never has been enshrouded in mystery as though we couldn't define when human life begins. The real question that we're having to establish right now, that we're going to have to establish in this generation is where does human life get its dignity from and who enforces that dignity? In other words, if the greatest superpower in the world decides that a certain class of human beings, you know, the biggest power on earth decides that a certain class of people don't have basic human dignity, who's going to hold them accountable?
Whether they're blacks or Jews or whoever,
right,
or Muslims, and we think you can now kill them.
Right.
Well, we've got the precedent. You're an unborn child, kill them.
Right. And that's the point at which the dialogue is really over. I mean, the more I talk to people on the campuses, there are people who learn a lot from the educational presentation that we begin, mm-hmm, you know, that we bring there. And usually there are people who are already open to learning about that for the most part. But for the most part, the lines have been drawn in the sand. Mm-hmm. And that ideologically, you know, the war is just beginning.
You know, and so when we try so hard to educate people, we go to abortion mills. And there was a baby, say, 4 years ago at Planned Parenthood here in Denver. And Joe Scott, one of our pro-life friends, ran into the mother today just by chance, and they recognized each other. And the mother hugged Joe and said, thank you so much. Our four-year-old son is the joy of our life.
Wow.
Thank you for saving him.
Wow.
So their marriage is together. They just bought a new home. They would have, you know, so many people get divorced. Then they get an abortion. Then they get divorced. They lose their home. You know, they kill their kid.
Yeah.
They're depressed.
A cycle of what a treasure to be able to participate in, you know, in an attempt, you know, a successful attempt like that to save a human being's life.
Yeah.
And then someone's alive for decades.
Because you yielded
mm-hmm. some time. And, you know, to any Christian, you know, young or old, Survivors is a mostly a youth ministry, youth and college age ministry. But any Christian of any age who feels like they we owe God so much and we'd love to, you know, to serve him and find a fruitful way to serve him. And maybe you don't feel called to the mission field, but this is the way. I mean,
mm-hmm.
this is one of the best ways, and the fields in that sense are white, you know, for harvest in America.
So you guys are in Denver for about a week?
Yeah.
Doing pro-life events in Colorado.
Yeah. And Denver does have its own branch of Survivors.
Here in Denver.
Yeah, it has its own group.
As some other cities do. And so if somebody would like to help out in Colorado, they could get involved this week, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, of course.
Absolutely.
And do you got a number they can call?
Yes, we do. It's 720-308-0615. They can call that anytime, and we'll tell them where we're going to be, when we're going to be, and they can come and join up with us and talk to fellow students.
So they could come out for a few hours, join you at a high school or a college.
Yeah.
Sure.
And
yeah.
talk to some people about the very important issue of abortion. Probably one of the most important issues that's facing America today.
Yeah, because thou shalt not murder.
Yeah.
You know, that's pretty fundamental.
Absolutely,
and when
yeah.
Christians have felt that it's okay to be apathetic, not to care, because, hey, it's not me, I'm not doing it. But it's your neighbor killing her child.
Right.
And Jesus said, you love your neighbor. The Mosaic Law said,
that's
you
right.
love your neighbor as yourself. God doesn't give us the latitude to be apathetic.
That's
to
right.
not care when innocent people are being killed.
Above and beyond that, the Christian understanding of the most basic doctrine, Jesus' incarnation, God became flesh.
Hmm.
And he didn't do it on Christmas Day when he was born.
Right.
He became flesh in the womb of the Virgin Mary, you know, at the incarnation, 9 months before he was born.
9 months earlier.
So that literally God dignified every stage of human life
mm-hmm.
by becoming those. So mm-hmm. God in the flesh was an unborn baby once. So if nothing else should motivate us as Christians to realize that the God we worship was that
mm-hmm.
unborn
so
child.
We're going to take a break. Could you guys hang on for the second half of the show?
Yeah, sure.
Sure.
All right, Survivors, we're here. Bob and Yurt Live with the Survivors. Bob and Yard here with a live commercial break. So we're telling you about the plot. And here, in fact, I have a copy of it right here. It's a piece of work here. I think you'll enjoy it because we've been saying for, 8 years now? It's money-back guarantee. And it's expensive. It's not cheap. Most books are, 15, 20 bucks? This is $49.95 plus shipping and handling. And how many people have asked for their money back? I could count them on one hand in all these years. Because people typically, like the guy at church this week, he said, Bob, I feel like somebody opened a window and now I could see forever. Bob Benyard here. Welcome to those of you tuning in Denver on KLTT. We're talking about this plot manuscript, and this is what's kept us on the air for all these years. You know, here at Bob Benyard Live, we don't do just the standard, brother, bless you for calling, let's pray. That's all great. But we take on the battles of the day, like child killing and homosexuality, abortion, evolution, the godless public education system, socialism. And as Christians, we should see all these different issues as different fronts on the battle of good versus evil. God's on one side and all those who oppose him on the other. And the only way to get all that in the right perspective and to see, what should I be doing? What could I ignore? The way to understand that is to know the Bible, to know the Word of God. And so if you start with an overview of the Bible, and you don't need us to do that, you can take your Bible and read it through. It's recommended. We recommend you do it. Read it through a couple times, two or three times, and get a good sense for the whole story of the Bible. And then begin to become an expert on the particular details. And when you do that, you grow in wisdom and discernment, and you'll be able to see, what battle should I be involved with, and what could I ignore? So check out the plot, 1-800-8-N-YARDS, our order line, or go to kgov.com. All right, we're back. 1-800-8-NYART. That's 1-800-836-9278. So could I ask you guys a couple questions?
Sure.
Just about, not abortion, just current events. See what you guys think.
Okay. All right.
Because you guys are pro-life.
Yeah.
All right. Israel has just, 2 days ago, they targeted, using an Apache helicopter, I don't know if they used Hellfire missile or what, they targeted the founder of Hamas, the spiritual leader of that group that's been involved in over 100 planning and encouraging over 100 suicide bombers, terrorist bombers. So they killed this guy. Is it right or wrong for Christians to support killing terrorists?
I say I just agree that it's absolutely right. The most basic human right is the right of self-defense. And the Bible says, above and beyond the basic human right of self-defense, that governments are ordained to punish evil, mm-hmm. and also, by extension, to protect their people. That's their highest calling, to protect the citizens of that government. And so this was a bloodthirsty man who had set himself against not only the nation of Israel, but against all Christians.
Children.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And God, I quoted a verse at the beginning of the show in the Denver Bible Church segment. And it was Ezekiel 13:19, and God is speaking. He said, will you profane me by killing people who should not die,
right,
and keeping people alive who should not live?
That's just it. That's what we really have to get in focus out of all this. Of course, that was a bad man. He deserved to die,
yeah,
and it was just to kill him. What the nation of Israel and the United States of America needs to get in focus is the second half of that. Of that verse.
The first half of that
verse, right.
Killing people who should not die.
Killing
right.
people who should not die.
Right.
Because
exactly.
Because the national policies of both those Western nations have adopted legalized abortion.
You could kill babies. Now, in America, it's just slaughter. Open house.
Right, right.
Open season on unborn children.
Right.
In Israel, when we've been there three times so far. Last time we were there, we asked our guide, I should check up on this, but what was the law in Israel on abortion? And our guide told us that you could get an abortion with the judge's permission. Now, I don't know. Do you know the latest, Jonathan?
Well, I know the last thing I read is pretty dated, the Jerusalem report from the year 2000. and the Jerusalem report, the statistics they gave then was that, you know, the abortion rate is very much behind the United States of America. Our populations are not even comparable. Mm-hmm. But the abortions, I know for a fact that all the abortions that occur in Israel are paid for by the socialized medicine program that they have. Mm-hmm. And that, yeah, I can't say any more than I know for sure.
All right. I just looked up, just when you were speaking, I looked mm-hmm. up on the United Nations website, abortion in Israel. And this is from their website, abortion policy in Israel. Abortion is permitted to save the life of the woman, to preserve physical health, to preserve mental health, rape or incest, fetal impairment, economic or social reasons.
Oh, great.
Oh, wait a minute. No, these last two are no. So all the above were yes. Mental health, physical health, save the life of the mother, rape or incest, yes. Fetal impairment, yes.
That sounds right.
So if you don't have a designer baby, you could kill it.
Right.
But these two are no. Economic or social reasons, no. Available on request, no. So an abortion must be performed by a physician in a recognized medical institution with the written consent of the pregnant woman. A legal abortion requires the approval of a committee composed of two physicians and a social worker. Okay, now that's close to what we were told. We were told it was a committee of three with a judge. Mm. Now this latest document here from the United Nations says you got two doctors and a social worker say you could get an abortion for any of these reasons. So basically it's not as prevalent as in America, but it's legal.
No, it's not. And I have been told, now this is just hearsay, but from a Jewish friend who has a sister who is an Israeli citizen, that the majority of the legal abortions occurring in Israel are Jews that have come from
Russia.
The Russian satellite states in America.
Yeah, now in Russia,
where there are abortion cultures.
Yeah, and abortion in Russia is just out of control.
Absolutely, yeah.
Where women are getting four or five abortions on average per woman. So why don't we go to the phones? We'll see if we have a demon in this phone system or not. Huh? We're going to try it? Gone? Hello, is this Rebecca?
Yes, Bob.
Hi, Rebecca. Please speak up.
Oh, okay.
Go ahead. Go right ahead.
Okay. I have a terminal disease.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, but see, they don't know what it is yet. So they can't save me.
Rebecca, how do they know that it's terminal if they don't know what it is?
Well, because I'm starving to death.
Oh, Rebecca.
Yeah, I can't eat anything.
Well, why don't that? Are you on intravenous?
No.
IV?
No.
Well, Rebecca, why don't we put you on hold and we'll talk to you privately, okay?
Oh, okay.
All right, we'll put you on. Okay. Put you on hold. Hit hold there. And we'll get Rebecca either to call in after the show or we'll call her back. All right. So, all right. Now, we were talking about Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And you've heard it's mostly Russia.
The thing, you know, depending, we could talk about what the statistics are and what the policies are on either nations. Bottom line is we're tolerating it in both nations. We've to a certain degree legalized it in most of them. Of the nations that have a constitutional Western tradition in their government.
Right. Now, Jonathan, my son Nathaniel, he knows what I believe on pretty much everything because
sure.
he's had no choice.
Sure.
He's had to live with me for a long time. Yeah. But I want to ask you, let you know how we deal with this. When they talk about the life of the mother, this is how we have presented that on the air for 13 years. And in our pro-life efforts here in Colorado,
mm-hmm.
is that if there is a baby, let's say it's an ectopic pregnancy where the baby
right.
is caught in the fallopian tube,
right.
and if it's left there, it would kill the mother and kill the baby.
Mm-hmm.
What we say is what moral people would do is this. The goal is to save the baby and save the mother.
Right.
If there's any way to do that, you do that.
Right.
If you're trying to save both and you can't, and you save one, that's okay. You save as many of your patients as you can. You don't intentionally kill one to save the other.
That's right. That's
so right now we save, we take the baby out of the fallopian tube. It's going to die. We save the mother. We wish we could save the baby.
Right.
If we could somehow implant the baby and save it, we would.
Right.
But we can't at this point.
At this point, so, technologically.
So is that how – is that proper?
I agree with that. It's like you know, it's the goal is to conserve, is to save as much human life as possible. It's like in the military when they're qualifying you for certain positions in the military, they will give you a test, you know, a scenario, and you've got to answer it very quickly. Where you're driving up a mountain pass, you know, maybe a one lane mountain pass. You come around a corner, go in the speed limit. You've got a company of Marines in the back. You come around the corner, there's a baby in the road. I mean, it's a horrible scenario.
Right.
But you've got two options, and there's no other option, just these two options. You either
go
run off the
cliff,
you kill yourself and all the Marines, or you go over that baby. Mm-hmm. And as much as you'd hate to do it, as much of a terrible thought as it is, the correct decision is to conserve human life and go over the baby. Mm. And I think it's a case like that.
So we're not saying that that there's no possible way that you would say some innocent life may die.
Right.
When you fight a war, a just war, innocent lives are often lost.
That's correct. Yeah.
And that's typically unavoidable in war.
That's right. That's right.
And so that doesn't mean what you're doing is wrong, but when it comes to matters of life and death, it's crucial that the people who are in charge know the difference between right and wrong.
That's right.
And in the world today, what leaders know the difference between right and wrong?
That's the scary thing.
I can't find them.
It should be these Western leaders. It should be people like the President of the United States, our branches of government. But they're failing us, you know, horribly in this area. Well, and
George Bush has appointed so many judges who are pro-abortion and who are pro-homosexual and pro-evolution and socialism and... but pro-abortion judges. And George Bush has been asked, the judges he has nominated have been asked, was the abortion issue brought up in the
selection process?
Yeah, in the interview process, your view is if it's okay to kill babies or not.
Right.
And judges say, no, that's not an issue. George Bush has said that's not an issue. When he nominates judges, he does not consider their position on abortion. And he's nominated many judges who are staunch child killers.
Well, I don't know why we should be surprised. We've been engaging, you know, as a pro-life community, many Republicans have been engaging in wishful thinking in our vote and in the way we look at politics from a pro-life perspective. Because, you know, I mean, first of all, just looking at his family, his mother is in a sense a pro-abortion activist. His wife
is a pro-abort.
That's right. That's right.
And
what do you expect a man to raise himself above? Not that it's impossible.
His mother and his wife. Yeah, right. Not right. It's possible, but he hasn't done that. In the campaign, Laura Bush was very coy when asked about abortion, and she always evaded the issue. Right after they won, I've got the quote on my computer in the media. She said, well, I'm against overturning Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm.
That was right after he won.
She said it.
Yeah. So, like, right now, she's somewhat coy about homosexual marriage. She doesn't come right out and say it's wrong.
We've got a vice president's daughter is in a relationship with another woman.
Yeah, is a lesbian. And George Bush should say that's a tragedy, and we pray that she would repent because we care about her. All right, Bob Inyard here, and I've got a copy of the plot right in front of me, which we haven't talked about this much in months. But it's here. It's real. It's not just something you get on the internet. It's not just a net download. It's a 330-page actual book, and I've got some quotes from the back cover. All right? Let's see. Here's a Ricky Newcomer, major Bulls fan, Chicago Bulls fan, and a draftsman in Monroe, Louisiana. Quote, after a plot seminar in Louisiana, listening to Bob Inyard teach the Bible is like watching Michael Jordan play basketball. I shouldn't read that. That's too self-serving. Wait, here's one. Here's another one from Messianic rabbi and author Eliezer Urbach from Denver. Quote, take this startling journey into truth. So traditional at each step, everything appears familiar. Yet as an expert guide revealing new wonders, Bob Inyard brings the Bible to life with often ignored passages. That's too self-serving, too. I got to find one of these that are not so embarrassing to read. Let me see here. Gordon Carroll, Sheriff's Deputy, Denver Metropolitan Area. The plot helped me understand the Bible so that now reading Scripture is a joy and no longer a chore. That's okay. Here's an engineer from Denver. After the book cleared up many problem passages for me, and this is an engineer, I felt that each chapter was worth its weight in gold. Taking the weight of the manuscript into consideration, that made each chapter worth about $500. Now, that engineer, he was getting the chapters as they were being written about 8 years ago, and it took me a while to get chapter 10 done. And he said, Bob, I got $500 here for chapter 10. So I finished it in 3 weeks, and he paid $500 for one chapter. And after I asked Bert, the engineer, I said, Bert, it can't be worth $500. And he said, it was definitely worth $500. So I said, well, there's one more chapter coming, but he didn't pay another $500. So we have to question, was it really worth it? But for you, it's only $49.95 for the whole manuscript, 11 chapters, 330 pages, and there's a 30-day money-back guarantee. So give us a call, 800-8-NER, or go online at kgov.com. Oh, yeah. So I'm here with survivors. Two of the survivors are visiting Denver this week, Jonathan and Nathaniel. Nathaniel happens to be my son. But, yeah, Western leaders, Europe was supposedly Christian. Now it's completely post-Christian.
Yeah, well, I think what we've got to say is we you know, think about how, and I'm not sure exactly where you come from on this perspective, but we think about how God interacts with nations and the judgments that he makes over nations, that he's not just like looking at the state of the nation of Israel in the Old Testament, for example, he's not weighing, saying, well, because this nation is more moral than the other one or a better place to live than the other one, I'm going to let them, you know, have dominance over the world, or I'm going to give them success. In fact, you know, Israel was many times delivered into the hands of people who were much more
powerful and wicked
than they were. So it's not a question of whether or not we're better than them. It's a question of whether or not we are paying attention to the basic dignity of human life and doing the job that God ordained governments to do, which I would contend we are failing.
Yeah, we're utterly failing. The Ten Commandments lay out have a framework for a criminal justice system. Thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, mm-hmm. thou shalt not commit adultery, and thou shalt not bear false witness against mm-hmm. thy neighbor, perjury. Mm-hmm. So there's the foundation of a criminal justice system. Conservative Christians have gone all gaga over democracy, majority rules. And the majority, typically, if they get the opportunity, they all say, you know what, we want to steal, yep. we want to murder, yep. we want to commit adultery, and please don't get us in trouble if we lie, if we perjure ourselves.
That's right.
So perjury is no longer a crime, effectively, in America. Everybody lies at every trial.
Right.
And we legalize adultery and stealing with welfare and socialism, and we legalize murder through abortion, killing unborn children, and more euthanasia, killing sick, unloved, unwanted older people.
Yeah, and the focus, we shift the focus. Just like a man in the middle of adultery will shift the focus on other people, in his mind mentally and when he talks to other people, the tendency of anyone in any kind of sin that is leading to death is to shift the focus. So we focus on these bad people like Osama bin Laden, right. who are bad. They need to be hunted out, aggressively pursued, and killed.
In Christian love.
Absolutely, in Christian love.
Well, but however you got to do it.
But by putting the focus on them, it's also
convenient.
Paradoxically
it's
a way to shift the focus away from ourselves.
Right. Yeah. It's convenient. So we liberated 40 million Afghans and Iraqis. Well, praise the Lord. That's good.
No, we're the good guys.
Yeah, but we've killed more than 40 million of our own unborn children.
Right.
Jesus said, you got to take the log out of your own eye if you're going to remove the speck from your brother's eye.
That's right.
George Bush is going to be judged eternally far more for appointing judges who mm-hmm. kill children than for going after terrorists halfway around the world. I'm thrilled he's going after the terrorists, but when he appoints judges who say, hey, you can kill children, that's mm-hmm. his mm-hmm. legacy, and he doesn't know that.
Oh, and let's not kid ourselves. The people who looked him in the eyes and said, the Christians and the ministers and the Christians who looked him, and evangelicals who looked him in the eyes and said, you're okay, you can do things this way,
yeah.
and God's okay with you.
Yeah.
They bear a part of that blame
right.
as well.
Like the biggest Christian ministries in the country.
Yeah.
They, you know, James Dobson, when was it, 8 years ago or so, he wrote a letter. He said on his TV show, he repented. This is what he said. He said, "I repent. I will never again support a politician who's mm-hmm. willing to kill a single innocent child." Mm-hmm. Now, it was tragic that he had to repent like that, because how could you be so hard-hearted to support someone who's favors killing some innocent kids?
And still presume to present yourself as this
as a
man
Christian leader.
Who leads people to know the Lord Jesus Christ.
But the tragedy is, after he publicly repented for supporting politicians who are willing to kill some innocent child, like abortion for rape and incest. So George W. Bush, he thinks, you know, I'll get further politically if I support killing some unborn children. And if I nominate judges who are pro-abortion, I'll get further because I won't be viewed as a right-winger. I'll be a moderate.
Yeah.
And so then James Dobson, along with the rest of the Christian leadership, fall right in line behind George Bush, even though he ruined the Texas Supreme Court, packing it with pro-aborts. He appointed pro-abortion and pro-homosexual judges around key positions in Texas. And the National Right to Life Committee gave him a 100% pro-life rating.
I know it.
100%!
I know it.
And also, speaking about, you know, just weird, we're going out there fighting terrorists and we're killing our own kids. Saddam Hussein, he was stupid enough, or he was a very stupid leader, and he killed millions of people, or hundreds of people. But he was smart enough that he didn't allow abortions in his country. They were illegal to have abortions. Since America's taken over, abortions, they're still illegal technically, but back alley abortions are readily available.
They're happening now.
Abortions, not really back alley, but you know, abortions are happening whenever anybody wants them for any reason. You can get an abortion now.
Now, you know, Germany, abortion was illegal in Germany under Hitler.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason was because he needed more Germans to fill his army to attack countries.
Mm-hmm.
But later in the Third Reich, he had issued an executive decree allowing abortion, experimental law, allowing abortions, and so they began to move in that direction.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it wasn't that it wasn't that they were had a principal objection to abortion. It was they needed more people to take over the world, and that was Saddam's position. Also, he didn't care who he murdered.
Just a utilitarian position,
right? Right, which is practical. You need more people. Don't kill your babies.
Right.
So even evil people could put two and two together.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, how about here in Denver when we've gone to an abortionist house, one particular one, because we don't have the energy to go to all of their homes. So we've gone to one abortionist home on almost every holiday for over 10 years.
Wow.
And our goal, it's Edward Patrick O'Loughlin, however you pronounce it.
Oh.
And he's a Planned Parenthood abortionist. And our goal is not to change his mind, because he's so hard-hearted, and he may one day change his mind, but that's not our goal. Our goal is to discourage medical students from becoming an abortionist, because it's been in the media, it's been in the national media, that abortionists get harassed even at their homes, even on Christmas morning, Easter morning, July 4th, Thanksgiving. They get these domestic terrorists in front of their house. And so our goal –
health terrorists is what we've been calling
health terrorists. So our goal is to say, hey, there's no child killing with serenity in our community. You kill kids. We're going to do everything we can to make your life miserable and discourage others from following in your footsteps.
Yeah, I think that's a great tactic. We've gone to a few of the national or local chapter meetings of the National College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, which is one of the main physicians group for obstetricians and gynecologists, is a pro-abort lobbying group at the same time. So many even physicians and obstetricians who think of themselves as pro-life, you know, participate in this, pay the dues to this membership. And we've tried, you know, that's another tactic, is to try to find those connections and just make it dirty, just make it seem filthy, which is the reality of what it is.
Yeah,
any involvement with the abortion industry at any level, whether it's lobbying or even membership in a lobbying organization is involving yourself in innocent blood and innocent bloodshed.
Well, and again, Nathaniel, living with us for the past 18 years, he knows what we believe. But Jonathan, let me ask you, we've said for years that the U.S. Supreme Court, the nine justices, seven of the nine were appointed by Republican presidents.
Right.
And it's a pro-abortion court.
Right.
So what makes us think that another Republican president is going to turn the tide?
Oh.
We got seven and nine, and they're pro-aborts.
It's foolish. It's wishful thinking. It's wishful thinking.
And that's counter, it's counter to reality in history.
That's right. Jesus said that he came to, you know, he is the truth, and the truth would set us free. And yet Christians are modeling a type of Christianity, at least in our politics, where we go on with this wishful thinking year after year that we would never
do evil
accept.
That good may come of it.
Right.
Appoint pro-abortion judges, vote for pro-abortion, somewhat pro-abortion politicians, because we'll gradually win, which is not true.
No,
it doesn't work that way.
The whole idea of incrementalism, you know, it keeps the pro-life lobbyists running, keeps the pro-choice lobbyists running.
National Right to Life gets how much money? $500,000
it's,
a year?
It's millions.
From the Republican National Committee.
That's right.
When does a political party give money to a special interest?
Well, I didn't.
Oh, yeah. It's because they're in their hip pocket. It's not the National Right to Life Committee. It's the National Republican Lobbying Committee.
Well, I've seen the fruit of that, because National Right to Life has done many things to divert you know, actual pro-life activism like describing, going to the abortionist homes, things that have proven themselves
against,
to be effective, that have proven themselves to be effective in deterring abortion.
They've opposed faithful pro-life candidates for pro-choice Republican candidates 1,000 times over around the country. National Right to Life Committee.
God help us.
They're the enemy. They are the enemy. Now, Colorado Right to Life is fabulous. It's fabulous.
I heard that.
It doesn't put up with any of that national garbage.
That's good.
But the U.S. Supreme Court, you know, we got Rehnquist, Scalia, and pro-lifers like the National Right to Life Committee. They say they're pro-life judges, justices. Mm-hmm. Well, they have written, they've said that if they believe Roe v. Wade should be overturned, but if any state, the legislature, votes to legalize abortion, then that's the proper way to do it. So that states could legalize abortion, that's not pro-life, that's pro-choice.
Well, I don't know if the Constitution – I hear what you're saying. I don't know if the Constitution gives them any provision for – you know, if they were to be strict constructionists.
Well, let me run this by you. No one could deprive someone of life or liberty without due process.
Right, and that would make it a
that's
federal –
in the federal Constitution. Yeah. So you can't kill someone. A state can't say, if you get a C on your report card, we're going to kill you.
Right, right.
That would violate – and no government – has the right to allow a subdivision of government to legalize rape, murder, stealing. There's no way that should be doable.
Well, the problem is, I'm just kind of thinking out loud now, but that would really put it in, you know, unless there was an amendment to the Constitution that defined when life begins, that would put it within the province of the judges.
How about the preamble? The preamble says that this is for ourselves and our posterity.
And our posterity.
Now, is an unborn child, by definition, some part of your posterity?
Absolutely. I mean, they were talking generations not even conceived yet.
Right. Yeah. So the unborn child, certainly, look it up in the dictionary. It's your posterity.
I agree.
So anyway, hey, guys, thank you. Survivors.
Thank you.
Hey. In Denver, in Colorado for a week.
Lord bless you.
Thank you, Jonathan. Colorado doesn't know how lucky it is to have these Christians, how blessed, here helping us fight our child killers. So if you're in the Denver area, you want to help this week, call 720-308-0615. That's a number you can reach the survivors. If you're a pro-abort, call them just to harass them. But if you're a pro-lifer and you want to help out, call 720-308-0615, especially if you're younger. Survivors is a group, you know, people who survived who haven't been killed since Roe v. Wade, 1973. But if you're older, well, you could give money anyway, can't you? Survivors.LA, survivors.LA, that's their website, or 720-308-0615. So come on out to Denver Bible Church, and now, well, let's see here. This Bobby didn't remind you to do right and risk the consequences. I forgot it was the end of the show. I tripped myself up.